I want to talk about InfluAds for a minute. They're not just the sponsors of this podcast. They're also an advertising network that I've used since the very beginning with Talentopoly. I find it a lot easier to use than Google AdWords. I don't have to spend a lot of money to fine-tune my ad campaigns. I simply select what community I want my ad to run in, like web development. I come up with a nice image, some text to go with it, and I start my ad. And it converts much better than ads that I've run on Facebook or Google AdWords. Sites that show InfluAds only show one ad per page, so you don't have to worry about being on a cluttered page with a lot of ads. It's all very high quality, and because they have some top publishers in their network, you're going to reach some very talented people. So check them out at InfluAds.com.
Raj, Raj, Raji, Raji, Raj, Raji, 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 Raj, Raj, Raji, Raji, Raj, Raji,
Ibi Ibi Raji King.
You're listening to episode 17 of the Talentopoly podcast, where we discuss some of the best links posted on talentopoly.com each week. I'm your host, Jared Brown.
And I'm Steve Dixon. You can follow me over on Twitter at Stephen M. Dixon.
I'm Brandon Corbin, and I do not have Twitter.
That is not true. But this week, I'm really excited. We're joined by a special guest, Raji King. Hey, Raji, how's it going?
It's going great now that I'm drinking my Trappist ale.
Sweet.
Look at that segue right into beverage introductions.
Nicely done.
Boom.
What type of beer is that?
Okay, so I'm drinking, we have a little cellar here called Topper's Cellar, and I'm drinking something called Orval Trappist Ale, and it's got a fish with a ring in its mouth. And I have a story to tell about it, but I think it's far too long considering this massive laundry list of things we need to talk about. So let's just say it's light, a little bit springy, not the best Belgian I've ever had, but it's pretty good.
Oh, it's a Belgian. That's awesome. Love it. What's the alcohol on that, like 8%?
Usually Trappists are like 11. Like there's some I've had that are like 12%. This is actually surprisingly low. It's like 6.9 for a Trappist.
Right.
Barley wine, not that high.
Good deal. What are you drinking, Brandon?
Right now I'm drinking water because I just came from a business meeting and I had about three or four, don't tell the wife, IPAs from Scotty's Brew House. and I'm not exactly sure what alcohol content or even what it was, honestly. But so now it's water.
That sounds like a good business meeting.
It wow. was a great business meeting.
Anything's great when you have four IPAs, dude.
Yes.
All right, Stephen, what are you drinking tonight?
Tonight, I'm drinking a cool, awesome British beer. It's called John Smith's Extra Smooth, and it is a wonderful bitter, and it's really smooth. So when I drink it, it makes my throat happy.
That is your English. That's your American accent,
that's
dude.
His American accent.
What? Let's see how long you can keep it up.
I don't want an iota of British accent coming through today.
Yeah, we're sick of the Brits. Come on, move. Oh, wait, did we lose half your leadership? There goes two people.
Yep, there's two of the four right there.
Yeah.
Wow, cool.
Roger King, ladies and gentlemen.
Apparently, it's knock on Talentopoly Day.
It is.
Sweet.
That's every day. So I decided to get a little classy tonight, and I poured myself a San Pellegrino. The orange San Pellegrino with some Grey Goose.
So is that the Orangina?
Yeah,
that stuff's great.
That was sweet.
Like Arenciata. I don't even know how you say this.
Yes.
I'm just not classy those are enough to know how to pronounce that. But it tastes great. And you can mix it with pretty much any type of liquor you want, and it's going to be a good drink.
So what's the you put Grey Goose in, is that right?
Yeah, I put some Grey Goose in there.
So and you went high class.
I did. I broke out the good spinach stuff for you.
That's awesome.
What's up, Steven?
What's the percentage on the San Pellegrino?
Mixed with the Grey Goose? I don't know. I poured about two shots in.
Oh.
So, okay. Two ten shots.
Of Grey Goose. Yes.
Two multiplied by five. Round up. Carry the two. We've got four shots.
Nice.
Sweet.
So before we get into the articles, there are a couple of things that we really wanted to talk to you about, Raji. And the first one is something that I've been waiting excitedly to see the release of for quite a while now, which is the Mad Mimmy redesign that you've been a part of. And I'd love to just hear how that's been going and what you've kind of learned along the way doing that.
Okay. So quick question. How much time do you think you'd like? I could go on for hours, but
this
probably
a
within a few
podcast.
Minutes.
It's a 5-hour podcast.
Five-hour podcast.
So, yeah.
Perfect. No wonder we only have four readers. Okay. All right. I'm assuming it's a few minutes, so I'm gonna stick with a few minutes.
Yes.
Okay. So Mad Mimi was this project that Gary Levitt came to me. He's the owner. He came to me about a year ago. A little over a year ago, and he wanted to buy a week of my time. He literally just wanted like an aesthetic redesign for the external, for the actual like front facing consumer website. And Gary's kind of a weird cat. He we talked about this a little bit earlier. Mad Mimi is this very wonky, weird looking, strange, like most web designers would be snooty and say it sucks kind of a site. But I think Mad Mimi is the perfect example of listen to your customers, have great customer service, have a spirit about you and have a character about you. And they've done that. And while most designers might not agree that it's like the most stunning design wise, their customers absolutely love them. And they've actually done a lot of things in a very like different and intuitive way. I think the one thing that Mad Mimi did is they thought out of the box. They didn't make things because they wanted them to look like trend. They made things because, well, they wanted them to be fun and spirited and work good and be fast.
And that seems to come through in the current design, I would say. I mean, it looks fun and it kind of feels personable. Like the about page has a picture of the founder right on it. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah, I think it comes across in a world filled with a bunch of facades and a bunch of like, you don't know what's really behind the business and the intentions. It comes across refreshingly straightforward and authentic. And the product itself is great too. Just the way they thought about conquering the problem of creating a promotion, an email promotion, is just really simple and to the point and fun and easy. And I think that's what they wanted to do. They wanted to come across to the group of people that they're not techies. They don't want to spend 4 hours on an email design. They don't care if they have a designer for it. They just want to make it look good and send it out. Done. Right. Simple. They're not designers. They're old women with cookie shops or, you know, whatever. So, Steven, you cannot tweet while I'm talking.
I know. I heard everybody's phone kind of go.
It's like, bleep, bleep, bleep.
My phone is off, so wasn't mine.
That wasn't me.
That was
somebody's gonna have to own up to that.
Yeah, somebody is. Okay, so fast forward to the redesign. I think the important thing to say about it is that it was cool because I just kind of gave them my all, and it was really organic and fluid. What I loved about redesigning for them is that it didn't fit into a box. It was like, oh, what do you think you should do? I think this should be better. Like almost like as if two kindergartners were in a room and they were trying to create something together. Like they don't have any preconceived ideas of what it should become. And it was like, work on that. Work on this. I think we should have illustrations. Well, can you illustrate? I think I can do pretty good. Okay, I'll do it. So it was that kind of stuff. And it just grew from there. I was like, oh yeah, I like those illustrations. Let's continue. Oh, those are fun, wonky buttons. Let's do that. So we finished the front end of the site, and then Gary was like, I want you to do the whole back end. And we started just literally skinning it, like, okay, reskin it, make it look better. And then it was like, well, why reskin it? While we're at this, we may as well rethink it. Like, we may as well do things differently. What do you think? Oh, I think we should do this. And he challenged me, and I challenged him, and it was just like this really crazy experience. Where it didn't feel like work, and it also didn't feel like it was too formal. And I think that was the magic of Gary, the whole leader of Mad Mimi. It's like he wants – well, I guess I should end with this. Gary, his whole thing, and then he told me later, was we were trying to find the spirit of Mimi. It was like every step forward we kind of like questioned and asked ourselves, is this the right spirit? Like we're just – it was not like just a redesign. It was a discovery. Everything was a discovery. Let's discover what Mad Mimi's spirit is. And he would just guide me. Oh, that's getting there. That's getting close. You're warmer. You're warmer. And I would keep iterating until finally he was like, yeah, that's it. And the weird thing is like Mad Mimi is not even – like it's kind of my style, but – but in a lot of ways, it's not even close to my style. And I'm proud of it because of that very reason, is that it was – we found the spirit of Mad Mimi, and it was something totally different than what I was comfortable with. And to me, that's a win because I'm trying to represent the company and the spirit of Mad Mimi and the people behind it, not myself as a designer.
Yeah, that's really cool. So it's interesting how you say the spirit of it, and it's not – so it's not really Gary's style then, or your style. It's more of this just original style that came out of that collaboration. Is that how you would put it? Or like what style is this?
I think that's a good way to put it. I think that, you know, he would just give me verbs and he would just keep like preaching to me words like it's zany. It's fun. It's a little bit hip. It's a little bit New Yorker. It's a little bit this. It's a little bit New York secretary, old school, retro, but not quite. Like he would always try to like peg it into this hole, like give me different like bumpers to hit against. Like it's not this, but it's not this, but it's kind of like this. And basically the whole idea was discovering the spirit of the application. It wasn't about trends. It wasn't about trying to – like literally we used some trends from like 1995. You know, it was like literally about finding – discovering the spirit of the application, not Gary's style, not my style, what Mad Mimi was meant to be. And since he's the leader of it, he felt like he was best in tune to that, and I had to listen to it. And I think that was good. That was a good thing. But there's lots more I could say, but I think within this, that's the most important thing that I learned, was sort of like designed to the application and the needs of the application, not to your style per se.
Right. And you didn't feel like a human paintbrush anytime during it?
There were probably like a few times that I felt a little bit that way, but I felt more like a human paintbrush in other projects. I would say maybe one time with Mad Mimi, I felt that way.
Which is pretty good given the time that you've spent on the project. I mean, we're talking about a big project.
We're talking about over like almost a year and a half. Granted, a lot of my time was spent like architecting the CSS and the HTML and like he was daring. That's the cool thing that I liked about Gary is that like – I should call him Dairy because he's Daring Gary. That's the beard speaking. I lost my train of thought. But anyways, I digress. I forgot what I was saying.
I like how you when you said about you know, not like putting your own personal style on it and neither his, and you kind of found the whole soul of what Mad Mimi is, because you know it's quite a good skill I think to have, really, because you know, otherwise everything's going to look the same, if you get me, you know, like too samey with your own stuff. And it's good to just think outside the box, which is the vibe I'm getting anyway right now.
Right. I think that one creates the leaders in the design industry, is the people that are willing to sort of like say no to trend and just invent.
Yeah.
You know, like think about before we had all these visuals in front of us and Dribbble and inspiration sites and all this stuff. You know, like think about old sign makers, like they just – I think they had that mindset. It was like just create something that fits this spirit. You know, I think about Walt Disney movies. It was like some of the signage and the topography that they used. I don't know how much they relied on stuff around them, but more like they just focused on the spirit of that movie because they were inventors the whole time. They were inventing styles. They were inventing everything. So,
yeah.
Cool. Well, speaking of styles and trends, something that came up in a warm up discussion, which I had never heard of before, was skeuomorphism. Tell me, what is skeuomorphism? I have no clue what this is.
Well, I want to include the others in here. So does anyone else here know what that is?
It's like including, let me find some descriptive words. It's kind of making it look something like, real. So if you're creating a Filofax thing, but it doesn't need to be real on a screen. It's weird. I really can't think of how to describe it, but I know what the whole essence is of it.
It's the idea of bringing like real life things onto the digital screen. Like when I think of design and I think of interfaces, I kind of get that Minority Report kind of feel, right? Like it's just it's like contrast and blocks of color and text so that you can read and you can tell where structure is, but there's no other spirit to it.
Yeah.
Whereas skeuomorphism is like the opposite. It's like, well, I had a leather address book and I want to create an address book application. So I'm going to make it all look leathery and I'm going to inset the text like it was punched into the leather. And then I'm going to put big rings on the side of it so it looks like binders. So it's strictly aesthetic, right? It really serves no purpose. It's only for the look. And a lot of people address skeuomorphism. A lot of people like it because they feel like it helps people transition, because we're in this weird phase of life. We're going from the physical into the digital or the virtual. And so I feel like a lot of people feel like skeuomorphism is to sort of hold their hand and say, it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And here's how it's going to be okay. Here's a piece of leather. It feels like home, you know, like you can use this. But let's just put it this way. A lot of designers hate it. I think they're kind of the Minority Report kind of designers where they think it's stupid. It's like it serves no purpose.
I don't understand why anybody would hate it. I mean, okay, for example, I was designing an iPad app and I made it like, you know, with a leather effect and it had pages in it. And so I goes to my parents, who are not like the major technical minded kind of people. And I say to them, what's this? It's on my iPad screen. What is this? And they say, oh, well, it looks like a diary. You know, because they have the stitched in the sensor kind of thing. I didn't tell them anything. I just said, what is this? And they said, well, it looks like a diary. Now, if I just showed them just some text on a screen done like a really simple, let's say, diary interface, like a calendar interface, they might not have just got it straight away. But it's the fact that they liked the look, and
right.
And
so it's your parents. It's sort of that hand holding, right? It.
Yeah.
I'm getting what you're saying, and if I'm hearing you right, skeuomorphism is a lot like icon design. When you design an icon, okay, what's the best way? I'm asking the group here. What's the best way to communicate a home icon?
I tend to like something that's kind of the silhouette of a house. Just simple, but
okay. Let's just talk. Yeah, simply about like a house. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Why not a picture of a nest, like a bird's nest?
That would work too.
Because we're not birds.
Right. That's a good point. Right. Like what the idea of icon design is? Don't be too clever. Like the idea of icon design is to strongly draw a connection in your user's mind to let them know what this is, to support the text with an icon so that they can quickly process what's happening. A home icon, a house. It's the best metaphor that we have right now for home. So it's almost stupid to not obey that. And so basically it helps them transition quickly to this idea of home. And I think skeuomorphism is the same thing. Like, it helps, like Steve was saying with the address book thing, it helps them quickly translate to the idea of an address book. But I think where designers really lose it is when they're like, okay, find my friends. Find my friends is all leathered out, and there's really no reason why. We don't have a find my friends application in the real world. It's an application that's new on the computer. So I guess I'll put it to you guys. What do you think?
I could see that argument that
there's
no – I like it when it – like we're talking about when it carries over from the real world and you're using it to help make people familiar with it with something they already know and understand. But the Find My Friends thing, it seems like you're just doing it because you think it looks cool and it's trendy. So all right, let's just do it.
Right. So then I guess I would ask – my perspective would be, why is it wrong? why is it wrong to use the Find My Friends leather, the leather metaphor?
I think, and I'm interested to hear what you think on this, Brandon, but I would think it's not wrong, but if there's a better metaphor that you could have found maybe by just searching a little bit longer, you know, I think if you just go straight to the leather or you go straight to one of these trends as your quick out, you may have not gotten to the point of discovery of a better metaphor.
I would repeat exactly what he just said.
The way.
Well, and sometimes with Find My Friends, there might not be a metaphor that really works, right? Mm-hmm. So you lend yourself more to like gradients, lighting effects, or it could be a flat design, but just colors and interface, kind of like swinging to that like Minority Report kind of like almost human, real world, spiritless sort of thing, and more like flat screen, like Star Trek Minority Report interface.
Right. Well, what about like those cool, like old maps, and you know, making it look like more of a map or cartography type of application, since you're talking about location for people? That seems more closely related to me than leather.
Right.
I don't know.
You could, right? But it's still, I don't know. I guess I have a perspective on it, which is a little bit, probably most designers will totally hate me for this, but I guess the way I see it is that I don't really care. Like my wife picked up Find My Friends and she goes, this is so nice looking. And other people looked at it, they're like, I really like this. And I think the problem is this. This is my perspective. We are a bunch of snooty designers and we get caught up in our own little world way too much. And I know that at the base and at our heart that we're really trying to like make the world better and do a better job. And it's all about like analyzing things to see that we're doing the very best job possible. But like, I think we get a little bit carried away too much. Like sometimes people like Comic Sans. Sometimes people like Papyrus. They do. And sometimes it's okay to use it. And so I think sometimes I just don't care. So that's my perspective.
I like it. It's a good perspective.
I like this guy.
The Find My Friends app, when I first launched it, I kind of felt like it was like a field guide journaly kind of thing. That's the kind of thing I got from it. You know, like it's weird as if you go on some sort of like Boy Scout safari thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's my initial thought. And yeah, it looks good. But yeah, the same question. Why did they use that design? But I don't know. I look
at it like if it's usable, like I look beyond the sort of aesthetics and I go, whatever, express your spirit. But like, is it usable? Yeah, it's usable. Great. Like that was the same idea when I built that Fantastical thing. We literally had discussions after discussions after discussions about skeuomorphism and why are we using, you know, the idea staples and things like that. And basically my answer was to add visual interest, to make it lovable, to make it not just a flat piece of something on a screen, but to like let people be endeared to it, you know? Like
Exactly.
That's why I like it. That's, you know, and I don't always use skeuomorphism. Not always at all.
Otherwise we'd all be using Windows right now.
Yeah.
Nice.
I had to include that in there.
I had to get it in there. So this other project that you've been working on for off and on for a while that I'm really excited about is Fine Goods. What is Fine Goods and what are your plans for it?
Okay, so Fine Goods is my store. I've always wanted to have a store where I could just kind of express being me. So contrary to everyone's thoughts on like, oh, it's going to be this mega marketplace where like, because I have a few more followers than maybe some, I feel like a lot of people think that like, oh, Fine Goods is going to be this like massive thing, like where we can like all list our products on. But no, it's really going to like shock people in that it's not that big of a deal. It's literally a store that has my products and that's it. It's fun. It's unique. It's got its own spirit. It's skeuomorphic, if we want to tie into the last conversation. And it's going to have like icons. It's going to have, I guess JavaScript plugins now, but I wasn't really planning on that. But I just released one, and then like T-shirts and what else? What else am I doing? Icons, digital resources, maybe textures, T-shirts. Yeah. Pretty much that.
Nice. But that'll be cool.
Yeah, it should be. And the idea behind it is that it's like it's a branded experience, that it's like every designer likes something that has a strong brand experience. And so the idea behind this, can you guys hear my kids?
Yeah, yeah. That's awesome. It's adding a good spirit to the podcast.
They're freaking out. I feel like we've said spirit a lot.
We have. I just figure it's like word of the day. So
spirit. Okay. So I don't know. Maybe I should let you guys ask questions about it. Maybe that'll be better.
Okay. Viewing. The killer question. I'll use my American accent for this. The killer question about fine goods market is, when does it launch?
Okay, so I would ask, why is it so important when it launches? Like, what are you looking forward to? And then I will tell you when it launches.
Okay, well, because I like your design. Okay, I like the stuff that you've done. I'd kind of like to see what you do, like, t-shirt-wise and the other little things. For example, that JavaScript, you know, plugin that you've created. Stuff like that interests me, so, you know. I'm interested in your product, basically.
So are you interested in it for just like seeing what the design turns out to look like, or like maybe buy something?
Buy something.
Okay, yeah. So I'm planning on launching it at around like December-ish. I want to be able to launch it in time for people to order shirts for Christmas.
Nice. Sweet.
But it's going to have icons. It'll have that that social media icon set. It'll have that one.
Right.
I have another resource that I've never shared with people, which is an overlay pack that does like skeuomorphic, like compact disc cases and things like that. Like things that like maybe you can jazz up your site with, like a just make it look cooler. Whether it's for some reason, I have a lot of like Game Boy cartridges and weird things in there.
See, that's that's what I'm looking forward to, because I love that when you post that stuff to Dribbble, that is exciting. Like the DVD covers you've done, the
compact all, disc. All of those will be in there, dude. Like, what else is in there? There's, my gosh, I can probably figure it out here really quickly. But
I think Fine Goods is almost a victim of its own great tees. To me, at least, I see that page, and you've got such a cool looking logo. I love the wood grain texture that you have there. It gets me excited. And every time I look at it, I'm like, man, I really want this to launch so I know what the heck is behind all of this. I feel like I'm seeing it with the curtains down. You know, and I want it to start. Me. I want the curtain to come up, and I want to see everything that's behind it.
Trust me, it's I do too. I really do. I guess I would say this much, but both the plugin that I just released that we'll talk about, I'm sure, in a little bit, and the everything that I create and everything that I touch, I'm like obsessive about giving it something that gives it an extra bit of like jazz, like something unique, and because of that, I obsess. Like all my friends tell me that like. They're like, Roger, you're the king of, like, the longest launch time ever. But, like, I want my products to, like, have something that makes people love them. Like, that's what I take from, like, all my love for Walt Disney is that, like, I feel like everything he created was, like, really special. And I want what I create to be really special, too. So that's why it takes so long.
Right. Well, that's also why everybody really wants you to release it. So that's good.
Yeah,
it's a victim of its own success.
It is. And honestly, I probably lose money on these things, but it's all for the love.
So do you have a T-shirt design being worked on?
I mean, I actually already have four T-shirt designs done. And people can see them on Dribbble. So one is the Fine Goods logo tee, which is just Fine Goods on a tee. The other one is the Adventure Company one, because – And I don't create things because I want people to wear them. I create them because I want to wear them. So
awesome.
Check that out right there. I just sent it to the group.
As soon as you get them t-shirts, I'm going to rock out Manchester with those t-shirts.
Manchester?
Yeah, that's where I'm from, Manchester.
Oh, I thought you were talking about like you're going to rock out your man chest.
No, no. My man chest hair.
He's going to get the chest pubes.
Your man chest hair. I thought you were going to pull the t-shirt down, get a low cut t-shirt, and rock out your man chest hair.
It's a V cut, right? I mean, you're doing only V cuts.
I am actually going to do some V cuts. Not really? Initially, but I am. I've got a lot of advice to do so. And so, yes.
Sweet.
Awesome. So, yeah, dude, like all these shirts are going to have like custom logo, like custom imprints on the back, like little screen printed, like large, medium, small. They're going to have custom woven labels, you know, sewn into the hem of the shirt. Wow. So like, yeah, they're going to be legit.
Very cool. Well, now I'm even more excited. So yeah, you need to hurry up and launch this.
I know. I do.
All right, let's jump into some articles here. Our first article tonight is CSS3 Secrets, posted by Nicole Dennis. It's a pretty cool little slideshow that goes through some things you may or may not know about CSS3. The first part here really focuses on bouncing transitions using these Bezier cubic spline curves. So you can do some pretty neat transition animation stuff directly in CSS3. I know you play around a lot with CSS, right, Raji?
Absolutely.
Have you ever had to use this stuff, or did you know about this?
Totally.
Awesome. So you've used this cubic Bezier thing before?
Yeah. Like, what's an example? I don't know. I think it's like it might be a French word. I'm not sure. I actually programmed in C++ what I always called, and everyone can correct me if I'm wrong, but like Bezier, I think.
That's probably much closer to the correct pronunciation.
But the idea is that it's a curve. Like, okay, have you guys worked with vector programs?
Minimally.
Okay, so when you create a curve, you have 2 points in a curve, and then you have like control points that you can adjust, like little handles that extend off of like little points on a curve, and you can actually adjust the curve out and in, and that's how you create circles, and that's how fonts are created and everything. And it's this curve thing called Bezier. I actually created a program when I was in college that did these things, just like Fireworks or whatever, like Photoshop or Illustrator in C++. But the way that it works in CSS is that you describe a path using a Bezier points, and it describes the motion. So whether it would speed up or like linear transitions, just move up like you would see on like a normal XY graph, like X squared. That's linear. Or is X squared linear? No, I think like 2X. 2X is linear.
Right.
2X is linear. X squared is going to be, what do they call it? Not quadratic, but what is it called? What's X squared?
Exponential?
Sure. We'll call it that for now.
We'll call it exponential for now.
Exponential. Yeah, I think you might be right. But yeah, the idea is that these formulas describe a curve and how a behavior might happen.
So what is a practical example of using these Bezier curves?
Okay, a practical example would be like when you see – I don't even know if this is practical for most people, but like – okay, jQuery does it. They were doing it before like CSS was able to do it, and it like transitioning images. Okay. Like, if you want to bring an image across the screen and you want it to grow, you could grow it linearly and just kind of like ease it forward, or you could like quickly bring it up and then slow down as you bring it forward. And that's like a practical example. Like, what I just released with my new plugin, Vue JavaScript, I put in a cubic Bezier example in there where you can actually like say transitions, enable transitions. And what it will do is it quickly like animates an image in, and then it slows down as it enters the center of the screen. And that's kind of a good example of how these transitions can be used.
Yeah, that sounds it. That's pretty cool. Cool. And the browser support seems pretty good for this, so I think it works in most modern browsers, so you're good there. And I don't know. What other CSS stuff looked good here? The styling based on sibling count was pretty cool, using the nth child selectors inside CSS. You do some pretty nice things with that. So you could say something like nth child, you want to do 3n plus 1 is the one you're going to be selecting. You know, if you have a grade system or something, that might be useful.
Nth child is a lifesaver, let me tell you that. It's just so useful.
Yeah, they have a good practical example here of adding color boxes. You know, if you're trying to create swatches for a theme or something, and being able to use the nth child selector to make that pretty easy.
Which slide is that on?
That is sibling count, right after slide 28.
Styling based on sibling count. Oh, actually, a really good practical example of that would be like a zebra striping, right?
Oh, right.
Like you want to do nth child, 2n plus 1 would be, they did 3n plus 1 here, but 2n plus 1 would be every other row. Right. So that's a really good way to do that. You could also just put in numbers, I believe, like nth child 7. Just like I want to target the seventh child. So which would have been like when I did my most recent design for that Vue JavaScript thing, I needed to create like 7 images and the center one being the very largest image. And this would have been a great modern way of doing it. Like target the fourth image, nth child 4, and make that huge. Target the third child, nth child 3, and make that one a little bit smaller. So yeah, it's pretty powerful, and I'm sure we're not even close to knowing what it can do.
Right. And the slides here do tell you which browsers support which of these CSS3 niceties. So that's
how do we find that? How do we find what supports the nth child?
Slide 28. Maybe that's it. Structural pseudo classes browser support.
Ah.
And it looks like all of them support it.
Internet Explorer probably 8 and 9 probably, I'm guessing.
I wish there was more information on these supported pages. It's specific versions and whatnot.
Well, I know without a doubt that 7, because Mad Mimi, we have zebra striping, and I believe that on versions IE7 and 8, we have to do just lines between the rows, because on IE7 and 8, they don't support like zebra striping. So you basically would just have rows with no separation.
Right.
So I think the support is IE9 and up for nth child.
There's also some cool stuff in here for background positioning, some CSS3 cursors. There's a whole bunch of good stuff in here. So if you're looking to really flex your CSS3 muscles, you might be interested in checking this out and learning a little bit more about CSS3 and what you can do with it.
Yeah, it looks like she's really put together a really nice set of things that'll really challenge people.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. All right, let's jump into our second article. I think you're going to have some good thoughts on this, guys. I'm interested in hearing everybody's thoughts on this one. Article number 2, 9 rules to make your icons clear and intuitive. And real quick synopsis here. They're talking about things like always label your icons unless space is limited. Always represent both the icon action and the object. So a paper airplane icon shows a clear action and object. Group things. Always keep the icon order and placement consistent through versions. Give your icons a common visual motif. So consistency is key. They talk about the home icon here, actually, and how much detail that should have to it. Just a lot of good stuff in here. What do you think is the, like, just not even necessarily what's in this article, what do you think is the key to good icon design, in your words?
Internationalism, right? I like icons that can be representative of whatever action or noun or whatever we're trying to represent that can span virtually any culture. And that's kind of my big thing. Yeah.
That's a good one. What do you think, Steven? What did you think of this article, or what do you think are some keys to icon design? I know you've had to do quite a bit of icon design before.
Yeah. I've read through the article, but it's basically trying to bring out the simplicity and the humanities out of something. You know, like everybody knows, like, everybody can relate to, you know, various colors within an icon. So, for example, like a red sign would mean something, you know, with stop, for example, as a sign. That would tell people, you know, not to go. You know, anything that kind of invokes like a natural response, you know, is that you just get. So, for example, like on a Mac, you've got the trash can. People get that icon. They get what goes in, a trash can. So something like that, that people can just get, that brings out the, you know, like I said, the humanities of something, I think.
when do you, going back to the skeuomorphism for a minute, how do you know if you're going too far? What if you're choosing icon metaphors that make sense to you? Like, Raji, when you're working on a program like Fantastical, and, like, there's this anchor icon in Fantastical, and the first time I saw it, I didn't really know exactly what it was going to do. And I understand anchoring things, but I really didn't know what that was going to do when I first clicked it. When does skeuomorphism not work for you? Or, like, you know, how do you decide that impossible thing of, like, what metaphor is your icon going to use?
I guess sometimes it's like taking a shot in the dark. With the anchor icon, we literally thought, and we came up with like six different icon ideas, and it was like we literally had toggles, and the idea of like when you click it, you would like have this picture of a window. It would look like a window, and it would remove the arrow. The arrow would drop out of the top of Fantastical, so it would just sort of like create a windowed application.
Oh.
But yet we still had this concept that it wasn't just a windowed application; it was a float on top windowed application. So how do we anchor it to the top? And so it, like, you'll notice that if you click on another window and you try to focus it, even though the anchor is selected in Fantastical, you can't move it over it. So right. It's not just windowed, it's two things. And so the most we could make sense is like anchor this thing, just anchor it so that it doesn't move, like, you know, drop the anchor so that this boat isn't moving. And honestly, in hindsight, it might not have been the best idea. Sometimes you just take a jump, you just take a leap. And in retrospect, like, it might have been better to, in retrospect and in knowledge of this article, it might have been better to label it, because when you have a lot of confusion, it's almost best to label. We put title text in there. We put sort of hover text, but not everyone knows to wait for that.
Yeah, I didn't the first time. But now, you know, then right after I hovered over it, like, oh, that very clearly explains what it is. But yeah, you bring up a good point, like show or hide, just toggling those words or something there, you know.
Right, or just like, you know, keep this application always open, or stay open, or, you know, honestly, the bottom of that sidebar, nothing's used there.
You could have
it's just icons on either side.
Yeah.
Always on top. And so we may have stuck with the anchor icon and just labeled it. And in retrospect, I think it probably would have been best just to label it. Label it and give it an icon, and make sure it's very verbose for a brand new concept.
Right. What about level of detail? That's, you know, a lot of stuff nowadays, you know, especially iOS apps, you've got a huge level of detail going into them. But you have things like the home icon, which, you know, may be best just as a simple silhouette of a house.
You know, it's got the best form of inspiration you can do is look at street signs, because you know, yep. For example, when someone's digging when you've got guys working on a road, you know, you don't have a guy detailed there with his little helmet and on all that on with whatever. It's just a simple silhouette of, like, you know, like a stick man, if you will, digging into something. So you immediately relate to what's happening there. And obviously, you know, there's a bit of, you know, color comes into it, red border around the triangle. It's all about making things. That's the best form of inspiration that I go to when I'm looking at things like, you know, what I need to, you know, if I'm designing an icon or what have you, because it needs to be simple that anybody can get it.
Yep.
Totally.
You know,
I actually think Steve hit the nail on the head. I think that it's all about it's almost with icon design. It's two things. It's about minimalism. It's about communicating the most possible with the least amount of detail, because typically, icons aren't a piece of artwork. They're supporting a massive interface, or anywhere from small to a massive interface. My kids are screaming. But I think I don't need to say much more. I think that Steven's right on.
Excellent. Well, let's move on to this next article here. Vue.js, a simple, lightweight jQuery photo viewer for the web. And this is something that you recently launched, Raji. I just happened to come across this today. I didn't even know you had done this at first, and it looks really cool. I'm definitely liking this. So if you want, just kind of step us through what Vue.js is. Why did you make it?
I was really frustrated with lightboxing, and specifically image lightboxing. I feel like lightboxes that try to be an iframe dialogue or a movie dialogue or all these things are kind of separate things. A lot of times an iframe dialogue tends to be more of like a dialogue box. So I think it's just like kind of like being cheap at being a dialogue box. Now, movies, on the other hand, I can see why lightboxing is really important. But my biggest issue was that every time I looked for a lightbox, I felt like the UI was ridiculously heavy. It was like there were dots along the bottom of the screen. There was big left-right buttons. They were all like one pixel highlighted, gradiented, and all this. And I was like, I know that they're customizable, but like it's wrong. You've done it in reverse. Like you've given me an incredibly complex user interface when really what I need, it's like icons, right? Like I just want a vector icon set and I'll style them. I'm capable of like, you know, giving them the correct aesthetic for my application. What I want is a vector icon set so that I can style it. And so I felt like what the world needed was images, like an image viewer and an image gallery that were both responsive, flexible, and like the least amount of styling possible. And then I also wanted to answer one more question, which was most of the logic was all being done in JavaScript. So like they would manually set like widths and stuff on these images. And I was thinking, well, to create things the most flexible, what you need to happen is you need to have like current and next and previous classes on things and let people style things how they want to. If they want the current one bigger, make it bigger. If they want it smaller, make it smaller. And if people want transitions, guess what? CSS has transitions now. And if you don't have transitions, who cares? The experience is mostly still there. It's typically faster and snappier anyway without the CSS like animations.
Right.
So that was the long-winded way for me to say that like I felt like the world needed something different.
Well, I'm really impressed with the responsiveness of it. I think that a lot of image galleries don't have that, and it's desperately needed in today's day and age. So having it scale to the viewport is awesome.
I agree. I think that's kind of one of the big ticket items for it is the responsiveness, for sure.
How lightweight is this? How small is it?
It's sitting at 6K, and somebody made a comment on Twitter that it's not that light K or that light considering jQuery is such and such a K. Like it's I don't know how big it is these days, but it depends on jQuery. So a good sort of disclaimer or a good thing to tell people is it's not always going to be jQuery dependent. jQuery will be ripped out of the core. The reason it was jQuery dependent is because all my projects are, and I just made it for myself, and it was easier to release it like that.
Right. Well, is it minified or compacted?
Oh, it is. It is. Yeah.
Packard.
It's Packard. So, but I mean, 6K, we got to think about this. Like, the 6K is not just JavaScript. I mean, this is one file, and there's no extra CSS files. There's no extra image files. Like, that's one file.
Cool.
So it's not just 6K for the JavaScript.
I think people get carried away about the sizes anyway. That's not that big.
I've got a question.
Go.
I've got a question. How much have you made from it so far?
Like $600.
No shit. And you're using Pulley for your processing.
Yeah, I am. And I don't know if I'll ever make enough to really cover the amount of hours I put into it. But,
sure.
But let me put it this way. There was a lot of discussion on the web as to like should I – okay, when I first created this thing, it was like, should I charge for it? Everything else is free. And so here's my perspective. I think as a web industry, we devalue ourselves way too much. We're at times far too desperate. Like, we're wanting to get traffic and wanting to get attention, and we give things away for free. I literally spent like 120 hours creating my first social icon set that I gave away for free and just asked in return for a link back. And literally, like, almost nobody gives me link backs for it. And to me, it's like, I think that what we're doing right now, if we give everything away for free, we're creating an entitled generation. We are paving the road for our sons, for ourselves. We're paving the road for a cheap industry that people are like, sorry, I don't want to get it. And that's what most people are saying to me these days. They're like, I don't want to buy it because $10, it's not worth it because I can get a free one out there. And my reality is, like, one, I put a lot of time into it. And two, I want to be able to make it good. Like, yeah. I don't want it just to be another cheap, like, crap, I can't put the time into this kind of project. And I want to be able to, like, add swipe technology so people can, like, touch it and swipe the images. I want to be able to put out, like, vertical layouts for this thing, you know, like different things, you know?
Dude, I completely agree, you know, the fact that you've made it like a pay for model, because me personally, I immediately know that if I'm buying something, you know, that there's going to be that kind of support behind it. Not necessarily I'm going to go to them every time I need help with something, but in future iterations, there's always that, you know, you're paying into something that's going to, you know, create better versions in the future. So, you know, I mean, look, if you look at Lightbox, I mean, that's really not come on in the years it's been out on the market, which is obviously, it's a free thing. Whereas obviously something like Vue.js, I can see it going further and further and getting better and better because of the fact you've got the pay for model.
Exactly. You know, that right. People, like,
yeah.
If I were to charge more for it, I could put more time into it. So I think what web designers aren't understanding is that, like, yeah, it's only like if I charge 20 for it, it's only $10 more. And guess what? You can stick with this plugin for a long time. There's lots of extensibility to it for your $20 if you would just give me the time to work on it. But if you don't want to pay anything, well, then you're not going to get anything out of it because I'm going to move on to another project.
Yeah.
It's only $10. I mean, realistic. Hell, it's even if you charge 30 for just the everything. So right now you have $10 for the regular license, $30 for the extended license. I mean, even $30, if you think about what you're ultimately getting and the amount of time it's going to save you, you know, yeah. So God bless you.
It's IE7, IE8, IE9, dude. It's like, that's a lot of freaking time.
Yeah.
Like,
it takes
a lot of time to do this stuff.
Yeah.
So
I think we do need to get away from that everything is free mentality. So I totally agree.
Definitely.
With that as well.
And it's not because we're like, we want to be greedy and take everyone's money. It's because we want to, we need to live to create kind of things. So obviously we need that. We need money to kind of produce better things. And, you know, that sounds quite weird. Like, oh, I just want money for this, that, the other, but no, you do. You need to be able to put money in the pot so you can make something better and invest that money, that time
spent. That's the idea.
You know, right? That's why if you release an icon set, that's going to cost a couple of dollars. That's why, you know, people, that's why you buy fonts. You know, you buy fonts because the amount of time that's gone into the extensive, you know, the whole time spent making the fonts,
There's a lot of time spent on, like, hinting and all this stuff.
Yeah.
Even web fonts, there's a lot of time spent on optimizing it for each browser. And so, I don't know. I think the reason that people get that about fonts is because I remember a short period of time where people were like, oh my gosh, fonts cost so much. Well, I think people get it now, and I think it's because a few leaders decided to say, screw the system. Like, we're not going to just do, like, conform. We're going to create something awesome, and we're going to charge a lot for it, and not a lot of people are going to buy it. We're going to keep doing that, and one day they're going to learn.
Exactly, yeah.
Totally. Well, I'm loving the discussion. We could go on quite a while discussing this stuff.
Yeah, I think that's a big topic.
Yes. And maybe it's something we'll revisit in a later podcast for sure.
Sure.
What I'm going to do now is something we haven't done before and kind of institute a lightning round.
Damn, I thought we were going to take our pants off because mine are already off.
You do that every podcast.
So I know. There's like, I literally ran in the door and I'm like, pants are off.
Nice. Let's talk about, in 60 seconds or less, live reload. See your website being updated as you code.
Okay.
By Marcos Zanona. Did you guys get a chance to see what this is about?
Yes.
So, quick synopsis. It lets you,
no, I'm kidding.
You write your HTML, your CoffeeScript, your SAS, your LESS, whatever it is. And as you write it, this thing is monitoring the file system, sees that things change, can pre-process that code, will update the view in your browser so you literally can see things change in your browser as you write your code in your favorite code editor. I think that is awesome.
It is. It is, but I think it's for a niche market, like a niche group of people, because I have no qualms in typing some code in, going into Safari or whatever browser I'm testing in, refresh.
Have you ever used something like Firebug or the Web Developer Toolbar in Firefox and seen your changes live?
Yes.
I think that's a big time saver. I think that kind of you get that aha moment the second that happens.
Yeah.
So, but you still agree with you there, isn't something you would see yourself using?
No, I think it's for like, for example, say, I don't know, let's use Facebook. They could probably use something like this to see it right away rather than save or whatever they're doing, or I don't know. I don't know why I use Facebook as an example, but yeah, like I said, I think it's for a real small niche.
Brandon, what do you think? Really something you would use? Yes or no?
Yeah, so I could see myself use this.
Awesome. Let's move on to pixel hinting vectors in Photoshop. Nice little video tutorial here over at Method and Craft. Little 15-minute video talking about doing pixel hinting within Photoshop. Are you familiar with basically what this is touching on, Stephen? Have you had a chance to look at this?
Okay, so the terminology, I'm just trying to see.
I'm back, by the way.
Okay. And I know
he might have a different terminology.
Roger, walk us through this.
Thank God. Hopefully he knows what's going on.
I think Roger knows.
Okay.
I'm the reason the show is going long. I'm too verbose.
It's great. We will have to start a 5-hour podcast and have you back on.
Yeah, seriously. Let's go 10-hour just to hit a whole span of somebody's work day.
So, Roger, what's this thing about? Step us through it.
Pixel hinting. It seems like a strange title, but really the idea is getting really close in the vector level and finding those edges where a vector may sit on a half pixel and snapping those to a whole pixel. But okay, not
always. Wait. We got to stop. We've got to stop.
I do that all the time.
Okay,
then you don't need this article.
Next.
But this could be a problem. Roger, you were saying some people doing vector graphics on the web aren't really taking this into consideration. Is that
right? Fair? Right. I think that's fair. Like, you know, you have logos out there that you'll look on a website and you're like, dude, like that could really be a lot crisper. Like it just looks like literally they just scaled it down and exported it. And maybe they knew they could, right? Maybe they just did it because they don't care about the project and they're just rushing. But the idea is, and it's the same thing, it's not just logos, it's icons too. It's this idea of taking a vector icon and you scale it down to say 24 by 24. And all icon designers know this, that like every time you scale to a new dimension, whether it's, you know, say it's 48 by 48, 64 by 64, whatever, that every time you get down and the smaller you get, the more you have to hint, the more you have to move the vector handles and move the points to snap to pixels or not snap to pixels. And there's this whole sort of like crazy juju, like voodoo thing to like hinting and pulling those vector handles. Seriously, it's like an art. But I have a feeling that art is going to die out. As we get higher resolution monitors, we're not going to even need to touch them.
Oh, that's a good
so
point.
It's sort of a – I think it's a dying art. I've always felt that way.
Cool. The Great Discontent featuring some of the best, most creative designers. Really nice-looking website where they interview some of the top designers in their fields. And they've got some pretty good interview questions on here. Kyle Steed is the one currently being promoted here on their main site. And they have a nice little bio about him. And I love the like rich magazine style to this website.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going to say.
the design is killer. I love it.
It is. It's got real spirit and personality to it.
It's beautiful.
And is this something, I mean, were you aware of this, Raji? Is this something that you think is pretty cool?
Yeah, I actually was just recently aware of it because Kyle Steed's a really close friend of mine. And he was telling me about being interviewed for it. And then I've been asked to be interviewed by them as well. So I did a little bit of research on them. They are – what I love about them is – okay, there's a guy you should follow on the web called Plastic Mind on Twitter. And he did an interview of me. And basically what he did is he took this like – okay, so there's two things going on. One is most people that interview on the web, like they literally just send you an email and say, here's your questions, and you answer them. And for the interviewee, it's really like painstaking. And it's not as natural. Okay, so like take the discussion we're having right now. This is more natural, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's more real. Like we have conversations back and forth.
Running with his pants down.
Exactly. Well, no. But that's the point, right? Like his pants down like gives us humor value. And
they're not down, everybody. They're off.
Okay, so his pants off give us humor value. We think about how small his penis is and all these things. And then it creates a more fun environment that we all are a part of. And so it makes a more real interview, more authentic. And so this is what like Jesse Gardner, Plastic Mind on Twitter, did for me. And I was really pleased with the interview because it felt real. It felt like a real conversation. And that's what those guys at The Great Discontent are doing. They basically scribe a real session. And I think it's an awesome thing that's going on.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. I like that they're doing it that way. Well,
yeah.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up here, but it's been awesome having you on the podcast, Raji. Hopefully we can have you back on in a future podcast. So thanks for joining us. For those still listening, congrats, you made it to the end. I hope you enjoyed what you heard on this episode. If you have suggestions or comments, hit us up on Twitter at Talentopoly. We're also on iTunes, Instacast, and we love it when people subscribe to us on there. And until next week, thanks for listening.